Now.
Have you ever heard singing, sir, out on the marsh? Rosie asked.
Grove stopped smiling, and she saw a strange look cross his face.
Didn't think you'd be interested in all that superstitious stuff, officers.
It may not be superstition, sir. If you have heard anything, there may be a very valid reason for it.
I've heard nothing other than old wives' tales, Grove said shortly. But I'd be interested to know what you mean.
We'd be glad to explain, sir. But not just yet, I'm afraid.
Charlie stood up.
Thank you for your time. He handed Groves a card. If you think of anything else about either the old house or the marsh, give us a ring.
As they left the room, Charlie turned back.
Oh, I nearly forgot. A colleague of ours wished to be remembered to you, sir. PC Gary Pritchard.
Gary, of course. He and his lovely sister used to come here with their dogs before I opened the practice in the town. Really nice man, Gary. Salt of the earth. Loved his dogs to distraction. Give him my best, won't you?
He glanced at Rosie, who had Willoughby still in her arms.
And speaking of which, I'm afraid the dog has to stay here, D.C. McKeldry. But my surgery has a small rescue centre attached. It's run by volunteers and a few of my vet nurses, so come and see us if you can give a dog or a cat a good home.
Not working the hours I do, Mr. Groves. It wouldn't be fair.
Rosie placed the little dog on the ground with a sigh. Chapter 23. Back at the station, Clive handed Jackman a memo.
This is from the pathologist, and just to let you know that I spoke to Grace Black. She was most understanding. She said that she realized a lot was going on at present, but she would appreciate an update from you when you have the time.
Fair enough, said Jackman. He skimmed the memo, then turned to Marie. The crime scene isn't ready to be released yet, but Rory has said that you and I can take another look around. And Ted Watchman has confirmed that a large entrance in one of the walls of the chamber has been very professionally sealed up. Ted has also ascertained that the work was done from a tunnel on the house side of the area. That means the beds and all the other stuff were brought in from Windrush.
Which ties it even tighter to Broome, said Marie eagerly.
Or to the man who has spent a very long time working there.
Mr. Micah Lee.
Exactly. God, we desperately need to talk to that man. I'm just about to ring Harlan Marsh and try to lean on the medical officer. Go and see if Rosie and Max are back yet, and then we'll get ourselves back to Windrush.
An exhausted-looking Rory Wilkinson beckoned them over and pointed to one of the small labels that hung above each bed. As you were thoughtful enough not to contaminate my crime scene, you would not have handled these cards and hence not noticed what is written on the back.
With gloved fingers, Rory turned the card over and showed them a line of small, faded handwriting. Date of birth.
Jackman thought immediately of Tony and the man who had demanded to know exactly when she was born. Partial dates of birth on each card. All have the day of the week, some the month, and others the year, and some have faded completely. But observe, on every card, the weekday is underlined.
Marie looked closer.
They're all born on a Wednesday.
Well, we can't be certain about the older ones until we do lab tests, but all the ones that are legible are exactly the same. Monday's child is fair of face. Tuesday's child is full of grace.
Jackman looked at Marie for help. Wednesday's child is full of woe.
Marie shook her head. I'm sure a good shrink would find it very interesting indeed, said Rory, carefully replacing the card. If we had one, grumbled Jackman.
Rory looked at him over the top of his glasses. Well, I do have a friend. He's a simply brilliant forensic psychologist, and he's retired, so he might be prepared to give you the benefit of his expertise. I can ring him if you like.
Jackman thought of the super's aversion to profiling, and the trouble that the last one had caused, then said, Yes, please do. I would love to run quite a few things past him. Good. I'm certain he'll be a great help. Rory's face broke into a broad smile. And he's simply gorgeous. Mature, yes, but my, if I wasn't spoken for, well, but I'm getting carried away. Now, before I forget, I have to say thank you for organizing such a lovely forensic anthropologist for us. I'll introduce you in a moment, but my, what that woman doesn't know about bones is not worth knowing. Rory turned back to the cards. There is one more thing about these cards. Well, it's about the handwriting, actually. He bit on his lip. This is by no means conclusive, but the technician who has been cataloguing the cards is a graphologist, and he's sure that a woman wrote them. Jagman looked at Marie and knew she was thinking the same as him. Did those vases of flowers and the neatly hung clothes, all carefully labelled, mean that Rory had been right all along? But what about the man with the strange eyes, the chorister? Could he be an accomplice? "Do you have any female suspects in the frame, Jackman?" Rory asked. "Sort of. We have a woman named Elizabeth Sewell," Jackman whispered. "She's in Salton General Hospital at present, unfit for interview." "Well, I'd keep a very close eye on her if I were you. I suggest that she knows rather a lot about our children's ward." He lifted an eyebrow. "But come and meet the oldest resident and Professor Wallace. Everything that we can do in situ has now been done, so she's packing up our girl for transit." Rory stopped and made his introductions from a distance, warning them not to get too close for fear of cross-contamination. Jackman looked at this expert on death and was immediately reminded of his Aunt Hilda. The woman that looked out from the face mask was short, stocky and bright-eyed. She obviously had trouble keeping her wild mane of greying hair inside the hood of her protective suit, which created the illusion of an enormous head. Jackman fought back the impulse to call her Auntie, and asked instead why the skeleton leg seemed so deformed.
"I will be able to tell you more when I examine the remains under controlled conditions, but I believe that she had an ankle fracture in early childhood. It must have been so severe that it sheared off the end of the tibia. Even now I can see distortion and a fracture-related bony callus. I would say that it never healed correctly and she was either not treated properly or suffered another later injury to the same weakened site. Come and see me tomorrow at the morgue and I'll tell you more."
"Do you have an approximate age for her, Professor?" asked Marie.
"I'd rather not guess, but if it's important, I'd estimate that she was in her mid-teens. Tests will help get that estimate closer to the truth."
"Professor, Rory Wilkinson says that she was killed much longer ago than the other victims. Would you be able to give us a vague idea of when she died?" Almost tenderly, Auntie laid a creamy brown long bone into a box and stared at it thoughtfully.
"As a rough estimate, 20 years, maybe more."
Jackman wondered who on earth this girl was, and why she had been important enough to risk exhuming her from her legitimate grave to bring her here. It was bizarre. Rory handed Jackman a sheet of paper. "I've had one of my techies prepare this for you, rather than wait for the full report. I thought you might be able to get on and make some preliminary searches." He pointed to the list. On it were all the details from the cards and a clear description of the clothes that had been so lovingly stored. Jackman knew that those clothes would be vital for final identification. It was not just the trace evidence that would no doubt still be present. Everyone remembered exactly what a child was wearing when they went missing.
"Thanks, Rory. I really appreciate that."
Jackman placed it carefully in his pocket.
"No problem. And I should think you will be able to have your scene back by tonight, as long as logistics can work out a way of transporting my patients off this marsh. They are talking about a fleet of all-terrain vehicles getting as close as they dare, and the bodies being ferried by stretcher-bearers from the tunnels to the vehicles. It sounds like the evacuation of the World War I trenches. Anyway, it has all been photographed, documented, swept and dusted, and everything of importance bagged and tagged. Hopefully the residents themselves will be transferred into my tender care at the hospital by tonight, and then our real work can begin." He stood back. "Now,
Dear friends, I must ask you most respectfully to bugger off and let me get on. Jackman grinned, thanked him again, and they began the long trek back through the tunnel. As soon as Gary saw Jackman and Marie arrive, he jumped up, followed them into the office and closed the door. "Sorry, sir, but I think there is something very unpleasant going on over at Harlan Marsh. It involves Cade." Marie almost spat the name out. Gary sat down heavily opposite his new boss. "He has taken personal command of the drinking club investigation, and he's keeping things very close to his chest. My mate has been drafted into his team to help them."
"Does he think Cade is protecting someone?" asked Jackman.
"He thought so to begin with, but now he's really worried. Take a look at this. It's a scan of one of the pictures that Cade commandeered. My friend emailed it to me."
He took a sheet of paper from his inside pocket, unfolded it, and passed it across the desk.
"Do you remember it? It's where young Nick Barley is talking to two men."
"The one where you and Marie both thought you recognized one of them."
Gary nodded. "Look closely, sir. This man is obscured by the shadow from the building, but I don't think it's one of Cade's buddies at all. I think it's Cade himself."
Gary lowered his voice.
"And guess what? Shortly after my friend got hold of it, the original disappeared, and the CCTV tape met with an unfortunate accident."
He pointed to the picture.
"No one knows about this, and now, sir, it's the only copy."
Jackman snatched the picture up and peered at it.
"My God, it's not clear enough to challenge him on. But I'd say you were right."
Marie leaned over and took it from him.
"So that's who it reminded me of," she whispered. "The bastard."
She looked up. "Boss, I've heard that there's software now available that can compare the shape and dimensions of the man in that picture. It doesn't have to be perfect, just as long as part of it is complete. The program just fills in the gaps. All we need is another photo of Cade for comparison, and we could identify him."
"And do we have that kind of technology?"
"We don't, but the university does. Ted was telling me they use a similar package in his department."
Jackman frowned.
"We'd be operating well outside the regulations if we did that. We'd have to be extremely careful. Can you imagine the furore if it got out? And supposing we got it wrong, we'd all lose our jobs for starters."
"The words shit and fans bring to mind. But if a senior officer is bent, we have to know."
Marie looked at Gary.
"You've worked for him. We all know he's a slime ball. But do you think it's possible he's mixed up in something as serious as this?"
Gary did not hesitate.
"Yes, Sarge, I do. I'd stake my pension on it."
Jackman looked as though he was sucking a lemon.
"So the next question is, just how involved is he? Is he at the margin, just getting his rocks off watching some dirty sex? Or is he in deeper? Although I doubt he had anything to do with the actual abductions. Surely even Cade wouldn't sink that low."
"Young Tony said she'd been to these gatherings several times, but she'd never seen the man who took her to the bogus party before."
Gary raised his eyebrows.
"This is just a thought, but would Tony recognize Cade if we showed her his photo?" "We can't do that, Gary," said Marie. "If anyone found out, they'd throw the book at us. They would say we were putting ideas into her head, and she'd recognize him anyway. Don't forget he's a friend of her father."
"But I'm willing to bet that Cade is only pals with Neil Clarkson because of the money he donates to police coffers. Somehow, I don't think they socialize outside lodge meetings. They couldn't be more different."
Jackman gave a humorless laugh.
"So, are you suggesting that we show her his photo, sir?" Marie asked.
"It's very risky, and we certainly couldn't do it with her parents around. With all these deaths, we really don't have time for this, but..."
Jackman shrugged.
"I do believe we ought to do it."
He looked at Gary. "This will be totally off the record, and you don't have to be part of it. Your job will be in jeopardy if you're caught." Gary took a deep breath and straightened up.
I'll risk it, sir. I know things about Cade that only a man who'd worked with him would. I'm ready to go out on a limb.
If you're absolutely sure. Tony really liked you. In the hospital, she trusted you more than anyone. Okay, you talk to her, and in private.
Jackman paused.
And I don't think it's the right time to tell her about Emily. Unless she asks straight out. I'll leave that up to you.
Gary gave a nod.
I'll play it by ear. But could I say something before I go?
Of course.
Gary took a deep breath.
All this photo stuff is fine. Of course we must follow it up, and I'm certain we could prove it is Cade. But I know him, and he'll wriggle out of it somehow. I think the only way is to catch him red-handed. We need to go back undercover, to another one of those illegal parties, and arrest him in situ.
There was a silence. Then Jackman drew in a long breath.
Get Rosie and Max in here.
But, sir...
Marie half stood, and then sat down again.
I know you don't like this, Marie, and neither will Max, I'm sure. But Gary is right. We need to go back in.
Max, as expected, was not happy. But Rosie was immediately on the phone to her new clubbing buddy, Will, and arranging to meet him.
He loves his brother, and he'll be just as glad as us to see the drinking club closed down.
She looked at Jackman.
I trust him. He's a nice kid. And I think he'll forgive me for lying to him. I'm sure he'll help us.
Since there's no way to stop this happening,
I'll go with Rosie this time, said Max. And don't worry, I'll make a real effort with my appearance to blend in. Then we watch for the texts. It won't be for a few days, but as soon as we get the message, we'll go in. And if Cade's there, we hit the place with every officer we can spare,
added Marie grimly.
In the meantime, I'll organize the photo evidence with Ted.
That sounds more like the sergeant we all know and love, said Jackman.
Frankly, sir, if we do take Cade down, I'll be dressing up and dancing on the table.
As he closed the door behind him, Gary suddenly realized just how much he hated Chief Superintendent Cade. The man had been around for so long, he'd learned to live with him, like a disability or a terrible illness. Cade's rank and the powerful men that he mixed with made him seem untouchable. Gary had thought things would never change, but now they had the chance to finally bring him down. Gary went to his desk and switched on the computer. If he got this right, and he knew exactly how to go about it, he could right an awful lot of wrongs. A determined smile spread across his face. He was very glad he'd come to work with D.I. Jackman in Sultan Le Fen. Jackman hoped he was doing the right thing. Risking his own job was one thing, but allowing others to do the same was quite another. He looked anxiously at Marie.
Do you trust Ted Watchman?
Marie nodded vigorously.
I do.
And go find him. See what is needed for that photo comparison. And tell him we need total discretion. This cannot get back to anyone, here or anywhere else, okay?
Marie nodded again and left the room. Jackman turned to Max and Charlie.
Could you two gather up as many free hands as you can from CID? We need to compare this list against missing persons and unsolved cases.
He handed Max the paper Rory Wilkinson had given him.
We have clothing, first names and partial dates of birth. So we need to start identifying the victims as quickly as possible.
Tell them I want their findings as soon as they have them. And Max, you are to concentrate on a young woman who had a severely deformed lower leg and foot.
We believe she was the first to die, maybe 20 years ago.
He paused for breath.
And Charlie, please ask Clive to contact whoever is on duty at Benedict Broom's house to find me a sample of Elizabeth Sewell's handwriting. Now I have the unenviable task of grovelling to the super about using that psychologist, and I think she'll like that idea about as much as an ice water enema.
As Jackman walked to the lifts, he glanced at his watch.
The FMO at Harlan Marsh had promised to ring as soon as Micah Lee was fit for interview, and he hadn't. Knowing what he now knew, Jackman wondered if the holdup had something to do with Cade. He still found it hard to understand why he would risk so much. A high-powered job with untold fringe benefits and a bloody good pension. Just to watch a few teenagers groping each other in the dark. It was all too much to take on board, especially when he had a psychopathic killer, 13 murder victims, as well as suspects to interview. Suddenly Jackman stopped short. Christ. Had he sent Micah Lee to Harlan Marsh, right into the tender care of a man who knew all about him? With a dry mouth, he hurried towards the super's office. This case was taking them into very dangerous waters indeed, and it was up to him to steer them through to safety. He just hoped he was up to it. Chapter 24. Gary had a satisfied smile on his lips. With no hesitation, Tony had picked out Cade from the 10 mugshots he showed her. As Gary walked back towards his old Suzuki, another car was drawing up at the Clarkson's house.
"Ethan Barley, what brings you to this young lady's door?"
Gary greeted the young man.
Ethan grinned broadly. "Got back together with Tony."
"Yuck."
From the passenger seat, Nick Barley was pulling a face at his brother.
"Don't you approve?"
Gary asked with a smile.
"No, it's okay, I suppose. Maybe it'll keep him off my back."
Ethan told his brother to stay put. He'd only be a few minutes. Then he loped up the path towards the house. Gary took a long look at Nick and decided to take a gamble.
"Do me a favor, son."
Nick looked suspicious.
"I just wondered if you recognized anyone on this."
Gary had been very careful. He had reproduced a close-up picture of James Cade from a police magazine. He had copied it and cropped out all the trace of a uniform so that Cade looked like any other civilian. Then he had taken 9 photos of random individuals from old cases, added them to the rogues gallery, and produced a perfect ID sheet.
"Anyone you know?"
Nick looked closely.
"Just one. That git there."
But he never looked that tidy. Gary's heart jumped. The boy had fingered Cade. Nick Barley handed the paper back. "He was often hanging around with the bloke who got me to copy the keys, and he was at the party in the crypt."
"So, how does he dress?"
"Always the same. Greased back hair, glasses, scruffy black chinos, a dark polo shirt and a black nylon tracksuit top."
Gary felt sick. That was the description Rosie had given of the man she recognized but couldn't place. She had actually seen Cade at a party, and hopefully Cade hadn't recognized Rosie.
"Dirty bastard," grunted Nick. "Is he the one that spiked Ethan's bird's drink?"
"Could be, Nicholas. And maybe he's done far worse than that."
Gary paused for a moment, then added,
"Would you testify?"
"What?
Go to court? Fucking hell."
The boy's eyes widened.
"It could do you a lot of good, son. Our boss would be extremely pleased with you, and she's got a lot of influence. And if she's pleased, I'm sure she could make things considerably easier with your father."
The boy sniffed, shrugged.
"I don't know. I suppose, well, I could, but..."
Gary smiled at him.
"Good lad. I knew you had it in you."
As he walked away, Nick called him back.
"There was another girl, wasn't there? Emily?"
"I'd rather we kept this to ourselves, Nick. I don't want Tony hearing about it yet."
Gary paused.
"Emily's dead."
Nicholas's pasty face turned whiter still.
"Dead?
What?
Murdered?
Abducted from one of those parties, Nicholas. Drugged, imprisoned, probably raped, made to suffer terribly and left to die. I'd say that was murder,
wouldn't you?
Nick breathed deeply for a minute, evidently near to tears. Then quietly, firmly, he said,
I'll testify.
Marie was pacing in the foyer. It was after six and the university had rung half an hour ago to say that they were couriering Ted Watchman's information to her. Then she spotted the leather-clad motorcyclist peeling off his helmet and ringing the bell. She met him at the door, signed for the packet, admired his big Yamaha, and gave him a fiver. She pulled open the large manila envelope and stared at the contents. She didn't dare remove them, as there were other officers around, but she could see the series of face recognition photos. Marie withdrew the short explanatory note, scanned it, and let out a soft whoop of delight. She had been pretty certain, but as the hours had passed, she had begun to doubt her own convictions. Now she held a positive match in her hand. She thought of Valerie, her dearest friend and first crewmate. She'd had a cheeky smile and blonde hair that swept her shoulders, striking green eyes and beautiful skin. She saw Valerie eagerly jumping behind her onto her motorcycle and daring her to break the speed limit. In their time off, they often went up the coast and walked along the beach. It had been a happy time in those early days. The days before Cade. Marie's eyes narrowed as she looked at the photographs.
Your time is up, bastard,
she whispered to herself. Then gathered the documents together and hurried from the foyer. She almost fell into Jackman's office.
From the look on your face, I don't need to ask, do I? Said Jackman slowly.
It's the result we hoped for.
Jackman slid the report and the photos halfway out, glanced at them, then returned them to the envelope and locked it in his desk drawer. This stays here until we need it. He clipped the small key onto the ring with the other keys and pushed them deep into his pocket.
Insurance. We are going to need every bit of evidence we can get if we want to nail Cade.
Marie yawned.
It's 6:30. Shall I send out for some food?
Jackman nodded.
In a while. There are a few things I need to catch up on first.
Could you ask Clive if he's heard from the lab regarding those handwriting comparisons? Marie caught Clive tidying up his desk and shutting down his computer.
I'm off home, Sarge.
He handed her a sheaf of papers.
All these are for the DI. The phone has been red hot in the last half hour. They are mainly non-urgent with the exception of the pathology report on the top.
Clive switched off his printer and locked his desk drawer.
See you in the morning, Sarge.
Marie murmured good night, picked up the report, and went back to Jackman's office.
Look, sir. The handwriting on the cards over the beds is an exact match with the samples that Max took from Elizabeth Sewell's annex.
Jackman read the report and groaned loudly.
This is lunacy. It doesn't make sense. How can a weak and sensitive woman, someone known to be both physically and mentally delicate, possibly be involved in murder on this scale? Because she wrote them for her beloved employer, Benedict Broom. What else could it mean?
Marie frowned.
But whatever it means, we now have a direct link between her and the scene of the crime. We're going to have to get her moved to a secure unit, aren't we?
Jackman picked up the phone.
Damn right we are.
I'll get an order to have her moved from the General Hospital to Salton Hall Psychiatric Hospital pending evaluation. And we need to speak to Benedict Broom again.
While Jackman arranged for Elizabeth Sewell's transfer, Marie went out into the main office to fetch them some strong coffee.
Max was lifting a pile of printer paper from his desk.
Sarge, have you got a moment? Things are looking good here.
The forensic team have done some work on the name card for the oldest body. It's Fleur. They're still working on the others, but they are hopeful they'll have some more names very soon. And the other CID teams have been hard at it with the IDs. We have a girl called Hebe Brock, a Scottish traveller who went missing 5 years ago,
date of birth tallies, and she was reported as having had the top of one finger amputated in an accident. Our victim had an identical bone injury. Plus, there is a 15-year-old serial runaway from Colne in Wiltshire. Her name is Sophie Berry, and she's been missing for 7 years. A date of birth, Christian name, a red jacket and a charm bracelet all match. Another girl is named Tessa Avery. It was assumed that she'd run off with her boyfriend to Spain, but her parents never heard from her again. She's been missing for 3 years and came from Surrey. Interesting, isn't it? So far, none of them are high-profile cases or local nispers. Emily was local, said Max. So obviously the killer was getting more confident. Then thank God we found his lair when we did. Good work, Max. Maria patted him on the shoulder. Anything more in the pipeline?
Well, everything we have is now on the police national computer, so they could get more hits at any moment.
Then maybe you should take the opportunity to get home.
I'm trying to find out more about Fleur, or really old Skeleton Sarge, the one with a badly broken ankle. Because of her age, I'm certainly not having as much luck as the others, but I'd like to keep at it for a while longer.
Max typed in another search.
Plus, I'd quite like to see if the PNC coughs up anything interesting over the next hour or so. We've sent out some pretty motivating inquiries.
Okay, but don't stay all night, kiddo.
As Marie went to the coffee machine, she wondered about Max's social life. Did he even have one? Despite his striking good looks, Marie got the impression that Max's ideal night in would consist of a takeaway, a pot of coffee, and fast broadband. Carefully balancing three hot polystyrene beakers, Marie placed one next to Max and took the other two back to Jackman's office. Jackman was just replacing the phone as she went in. He seemed edgy all of a sudden.
Something wrong?
Everything. On his face was a mixture of anger and mystification.
Elizabeth Sewell is being transferred, but I've just been speaking to the FMO out at Harlan Marsh and told him it's imperative that we interview Micah Lee. He says the man's mind is in a state of flux. One minute he's lucid and reasonable, the next he's climbing the walls.
Jackman glowered at the phone.
I don't have time to go there and Soddenwell sit around waiting for one of his reasonable moments.
Couldn't an officer from Harlan Marsh do it for you? Someone who is on hand to monitor Lee's moods?
What? You'd actually trust someone from Cade's Manor, would you?
Jackman barked.
I trust Gary, she said quietly.
So I'd trust anyone Gary vouched for.
They can't all be bent, can they?
One rotten apple won't have contaminated the whole barrel.
Jackman put his head in his hands.
You're right. Sorry, Marie. Ask Gary to come in, would you?
He sat up straight.
In fact, get the whole team together in the CID room. We need to talk.
Jackman perched on the edge of a desk in front of one of the whiteboards. Down one side of the board was a list of the victims. Full names, photographs, and the places where they disappeared were being added minute by minute. Already they had photos of Tessa Avery, Sophie Berry, Hebe Brock, and just a few seconds ago, Annie Crane and Lucy O'Connell had been added. At the top of the board was the name Windrush, and below that, Benedict Broom, Elizabeth Sewell, and Micah Lee. Jackman stood up and pointed to the name Elizabeth.
This woman is a direct link to the children's ward. However, we already know from Rory that some of the dead girls had been seriously assaulted using a great deal of force, and possibly raped. So that means that either she had an accomplice, or her involvement is in some way, he shrugged, accidental.
But she is connected to Broom and to Lee by virtue of his being employed by Broom, Marie pursed her lips. So, what if her employer asked her to print out some labels? She'd do it, wouldn't she? And she'd not necessarily be aware of what they were.
That, said Jackman, is what I mean by accidental. And maybe she'd do it for a friend, too. We need to talk to her as soon as she's been assessed at Salton Hall. Meanwhile, Gary,
I need to find a trustworthy senior detective at Harlan Marsh, someone who would interview Lee for us, and preferably without Chief Superintendent Cade knowing. Is there such an officer?
Only one that I know of, sir. D.I. Jim Salmon.
Jim Salmon? The same guy who used to be our dog handler years back. He's a detective now. Jackman's eyes widened.
Perfect.
I'll ring him as soon as we've finished. He turned back to the board. So, who else have we spoken to?
Broom's gardener boss. Bloke named Len Curtis.
Max looked at his notebook.
Funny sort. It was hard to get him to string two words together. But he has been out to Windrush a few times, with messages or deliveries for Micah Lee, and he only lives a couple of miles from Roman Creek.
Jackman wrote the name on the board. Who else?
Philip Groves, the vet who lives a short way from Windrush on the edge of the marsh, and two other neighbours, a bird watcher called Ralph Jenkins, and a couple called Ernie and Betty Coulter, said Rosie.
And we spoke to Bill Hickey, the farm manager where Micah Lee lodges. Jackman paused. But the farmer was away. What was his name, Gary?
Toby Tanner, sir. He's expected back from Germany tomorrow, according to Hickey.
Is that it?
No, sir, said Charlie. There were several other people living in the Roman Creek area that Uniform saw, but most were elderly women, apart from a couple who have a holiday let a bit further up the coast road. No one they pay a second visit to. And all the so-called neighbours are well scattered over a very large area. Windrush is quite remote.
Marie raised her hand.
Maybe we should include Asher Layton in the list of people we've spoken to?
It's a very vague connection, but he did know Shauna Kelly, and she has definitely been placed at one of those parties.
Plus, we also know he has a penchant for talking to street girls.
Jackman added Asher Layton's name. Okay, so we go back and talk to Benedict Broom, Elizabeth Sewell, and Micah Lee. And, on a different tack, we hit the drinking club again. As there were other officers in the room, he kept strictly to the abducted girls, Tony and Emily, and the victims of the children's ward. The organisers may have nothing directly to do with the abductions, but we need them brought in, questioned, and those damn parties brought to an end. He looked around at the tired faces staring back at him. Now, all of you who can, get yourselves home and get some rest. We'll start again tomorrow.
That guy is one serious fruitcake, said the Harlan Marsh custody officer as he closed the door of the interview room. Well, it's all yours, and the best of British in trying to get any sense out of him.
D.I. Jim Salmon wondered if he had been a little too quick to agree to help out D.I. Jackman. He'd already heard that Chief Superintendent Cade had tried to interview Mad Micah, and had had to abort the attempt almost immediately. He just prayed that Cade wouldn't get to hear about this particular effort. At least the chief was off duty until the morning. Along with his sergeant, D.S. Terry Langer, and a social worker hastily acquired from the duty roster to safeguard the prisoner's interests, Jim reluctantly entered the small room. Micah Lee sat bolt upright, his eyes wide and staring, and his nostrils flaring with anger. Jim Salmon looked at Micah, and decided that Jackman owed him big time. With a deep sigh, he switched on the tape and made the introductions.
Mr. Lee, we need to talk to you about an underground room beneath the property called Windrush at Roman Creek. That is the property belonging to Mr. Benedict Broom, where you have been working for some time.
Jim kept his voice even and quiet. He knew that Micah would react badly to any show of assertiveness.
We are interviewing you because of your knowledge of the layout of Windrush, Mr. Lee. Having worked on it for so long, we feel that you may be able to help us.
War room. I don't know about any underground room, boomed Micah.
Jim saw a vein pulsing in the side of Micah's head.
Surely you know that there's a tunnel leading from the back of the main house out towards the old barn and the storeroom, and that there is an underground room beneath them.
The big man looked like a caged animal. He chewed furiously on his bottom lip and drummed his fingers frantically on the tabletop.
I don't know of any tunnel. No, no tunnel.
Jim attempted a smile.
Okay, but do you know...
A keening howl suddenly erupted from Micah's lips and reverberated around the tiny room. They all leapt up. Jim's chair fell backwards, and the social worker uttered a little scream. Then, before anyone could move, Micah took a series of ragged, gasping breaths and pitched forward onto the floor. Jim hit the panic button. "Get help!" he yelled, and threw himself to his knees beside the unconscious Micah. "We need an ambulance."
"The duty doctor is in the building," called Langer. "He was dealing with a junkie as we came in."
He ran for the door.
"I'll get him."
The doctor was at Micah's side in minutes.
"It's probably some kind of panic attack. He's sweaty and tachycardic. He may well have hyperventilated, causing him to faint, but..."
The doctor checked Micah's pulse again.
"We need to get him to the hospital to be checked out properly. I'm not just covering our backs, Detective Inspector Salmon. I'm not at all happy with his condition. There could well be a neurological reason for this, and we can't risk leaving it."
"Ambulance is on its way, boss."
The sergeant leant around the door.
"And uniform are organizing an escort."
He stared down at Micah.
"I can't say I'll be sad to see that one go. He's one scary guy."
As the stretcher was hoisted into the back of the ambulance, Jim wondered how he was going to tell D.I. Jackman that he'd inadvertently hospitalized his prisoner. And even worse, how would Chief Cade react when he found out? It was very late by the time Jackman and Marie concluded Benedict Broom's second interview. He had politely but vehemently denied any knowledge of work ever having been carried out from an underground tunnel. He told them he knew nothing of any such tunnel. He also denied any knowledge of the name cards allegedly written by his housekeeper. In the end, they called it a day. Jackman had decided to keep quiet about the killers singing. He agreed with Marie that it would be best to keep that piece of information to themselves until they could use it more effectively.
"I wonder if Broom was a choir boy," mused Marie, as they left the interview room. "But he didn't grow up around here, so it would be hard to find out."
"Worth a try, though." Jackman punched in the security number and flung the door open. "But right now, we all need sleep. Go check the team, Marie, and pack whoever is left off to their homes and their beds. Then I suggest you gather up your new lodger and get home yourself." He smiled at her. "And how is your new role as landlady going?"
"Brilliantly. Gary actually does a cooked breakfast before he goes to work. He's perfectly house-trained, a wizard in the kitchen, and frankly, I'm thinking of keeping him on."
"Ah, then my Mrs. M had better watch out. Even I don't get breakfasts." Marie grinned and was about to say more when Jackman's mobile sounded. "Ah, Jim, what have you got for me?" Marie saw Jackman's expression drop.
"Shit. How the hell... Oh, well, it's not your fault, Jim. I'm just sorry to have put you through it."
"They've taken him to the Pilgrim Hospital in Boston."
"Yeah.
But make sure he's watched 24/7, and two officers at all times. Have you got the manpower for that? Or shall I get you some backup?"
"Right. Well, thanks for trying.
Night, Jim. Oh, and any aggro from your chief, refer him to me, okay?" He closed the phone and stared grimly at Marie. Micah Lee categorically denied knowing about any tunnels or underground rooms, and then he collapsed. He's been taken in for neurological evaluation. That puts two of our three suspects out of our direct supervision, and I don't like that one bit. Marie agreed, but right now, she could barely think straight. She was exhausted.
"I'll go sort out the others, then I'll see you in the morning, sir. Let's see what tomorrow brings, shall we?"
And speaking of the morning, Benedict Broom is supposed to either be released or charged at 8 a.m. So I'd better get someone round to the magistrate for an extension.
And considering what's beneath that man's property, I'll go on getting bloody extensions until we have the truth.
Chapter 25. After a restless night, Jackman rose early and, taking a leaf out of Gary's book, cooked himself a proper breakfast. He was locking the door to Mill Corner when his mobile rang.
Marie? Surely you're not at work already.
I am. I'm sorry to start your day like this, but we've got a problem.
What's wrong now?
Mike Lee has done a runner from the hospital.
What? How the hell did that happen?
It was no one's fault really, sir. Apart, perhaps, from underestimating his strength.
Jackman jumped into his car and slammed the door. It was always someone's fault when a prisoner got away. It didn't happen often, but when it did, it was after they'd got themselves into hospital.
Okay, tell me. Just don't say someone left their post to go to the sodding toilet or blood may flow.
No, nothing like that. They thought he was unconscious when they took him down to radiology for a scan. There were two constables and two nurses with him. But as he came out of the scanner and they went to replace the restraints, he went ballistic. He's badly hurt one of the Boston men. Concussed the other, and laid out both nurses.
No. Jackman's anger turned to concern. How badly hurt?
Suspected fractured skull, sir. Apparently he smashed their heads together. PC Bladen came off worse. PC Smythe is mildly concussed.
And the hospital staff?
Shaken up and bruised, but no serious injury.
So where did he go? Was CCTV operational?
Yes, he was seen at the rear of the hospital where he accosted a porter, took his clothes and his wallet, then went over the hospital wall and made off through residential gardens and fields towards the West Fen catchwater drain.
So we've lost him.
Jackman heard an intake of breath, then a sigh.
We lost him.
Okay. I'll be there in 15. Get me a very strong black coffee and we'll regroup.
Jackman hung up and gave a bitter laugh. For a while there, he'd actually been thinking today might go better. When Jackman reached the murder room, his anger had dissipated, and he was left with a feeling of things slipping away from him. Marie was the only person in the big room, and she looked about as cheerful as he felt. She held out a coffee and said, Max left a note to say that two more victims have been unofficially identified via the PNC. We need the lab results to be certain, but their first names and DOBs match. One is a youngster from Bristol called Corey Anderson, and the other girl, Charlotte King, is from Hull.
And neither rings a bell.
Our killer always took low-profile missing persons from different locations, didn't he?
No one who has ever plastered across the tabloids or made the media in a big way.
Jackman.
Marie stared at him with a perplexed expression.
I'm thinking about those dates of birth. What is it about being born on a Wednesday that made them a candidate for death?
Jackman's head shook slowly from side to side.
We'll only know that when the case is over. And right now, I think we'd better concentrate on trying to capture Mad Micah, don't you?
He drew in a deep breath.
And while we wait for the others to get in, will you ring the psychiatric hospital for me and see if Elizabeth is fit enough to interview?
Marie went to get the number. As she flicked through her file, she said,
So where do you think Micah will have gone?
The million-dollar question. If Benedict Broom were free, I would have laid good money on Micah going to him, but...
Would he go home, do you think? If he's mentally unstable, maybe he needs a familiar place.
But surely he knows we'll be watching. There are already uniformed officers at the farm, and Windrush is crawling with police and forensics.
Jackman could still see the anger in Micah's craggy, ugly face when they arrived to search Windrush. Maybe his anguish had been because he had known, even then, that it was the beginning of the end for the children's ward.
Marie hung up. You have a green light, sir. They are a bit iffy, but it's okay as long as her doctor sits in and we keep the interview short.
Jackman thought for a moment. I'm wondering if it might be prudent if you went and took Rosie with you. If this woman is so fragile, perhaps having a man asking the questions is not the best strategy.
You could be right, sir. And as I just saw Rosie coming in, we'll get off before the doctors change their minds.
Marie and Rosie hurried from the car park and up to the heavy glass doors of Salton Hall Psychiatric Hospital. Marie pushed the intercom button and announced their names. The door hummed and the catch released. There were no rattling keychains, metal locks or clanging iron doors, just pass cards and security number pads.
Dr. Mason is expecting you. I'll escort you down to his wing.
The receptionist was a smartly uniformed man of around 30. He was short-haired, tall and muscular, not the sort you'd willingly mess with. Elizabeth was in a private room, with two constables stationed outside. Dr. Leonard Mason and a male nurse were waiting with her, and let them into the room. It was spotlessly clean, and although rather Spartan, seemed comfortable enough. Marie had been warned that Elizabeth would be under mild sedation. She was perfectly lucid, but fragile, and her psychiatrist and another medic would remain with them throughout the interview. Marie had already decided to keep the questions to essentials only, just in case the doctors pulled the plug on them. They introduced themselves to this possible accomplice to multiple murder in the gentlest voices they could muster. Elizabeth looked at them with very little expression on her face, until her eyes fell on Rosie.
"What a pretty girl,"
she said, a strange smile twisting her lips.
"You remind me of... No, she was much blonder."
The smile remained, although Elizabeth's eyes were the saddest Marie had ever seen. She wondered who Elizabeth was thinking of.
"Elizabeth, your employer, Benedict Broom, sends his best wishes. He said to tell you that he's fine and that you are not to worry about anything. He said that you can talk to us quite candidly. We are only here to find the truth. Do you understand?"
Again the head tilted.
"Ah, yes. Mr. Broom. Benedict."
Elizabeth tugged at her sleeves, pulling them down over her thin fingers. Rosie added,
"Is he a good employer? Does he treat you well?"
"Oh, yes. I couldn't wish for better. He's very kind. I don't know what I'd do without him."
They could see her hands, the fingers just protruding from her sleeves, twisting constantly.
"But what do you want with me? Why am I here?"
"We have something here that we'd like you to see. We were wondering if you'd recognize it."
Marie placed a clear plastic evidence bag in front of her. Inside was one of the name cards from the underground chamber. Even through the film, Marie could clearly see the name, Lucy, written on it.
"Is this your writing?"
"I think so."
She squinted as she tried to make out the neat print through the plastic.
"I'm sure I wrote that."
Marie heard Rosie take a breath.
"What is it, Elizabeth? What was it for?"
There was no reply, and Marie managed to quash her overwhelming desire to lean forward and shake her.
"Is it yours, or did someone ask you to do it for them?"
The fingers twisted.
"Not mine,"
she frowned.
"But who?"
"Mr. Broom, maybe."
Rosie maintained a calm, even tone.
"It must have been, mustn't it?"
She pushed it back towards them.
"Or a friend, maybe?"
Marie asked.
I'm not sure."
Marie bit her lip and saw the doctor's sharp eyes on her.
"Careful," mouthed Mason. Don't push her.
She looked at the mousy woman more closely. She wasn't nearly as old as she looked. She was very thin, fine-boned, with almost porcelain-like skin, but there was something about those sad eyes that said she was not as fragile as she made out. Suddenly, Marie decided on a different tack.
Michael Lee is missing, Miss Sewell. He's disappeared.
The fluttering hands flew to her mouth. She gave a little gasp, and Dr. Mason found his voice.
Dears Evans, can I have a word, please, outside?
Exactly what Marie had hoped for. As Marie stood up and accompanied the doctor outside, Rosie remained quietly seated with Elizabeth. She would get the chance to observe Elizabeth's honest reaction to Marie's statement. Marie listened to the doctor admonishing her, but watched through the window from the corner of her eye. She saw Rosie's lips move, smile. Marie could also see that she was indeed getting a response. With only the nurse and the pretty girl in attendance, Elizabeth Sewell obviously felt less threatened. Marie decided to dispute the doctor's objection to her tone and extend her expulsion from the room a little longer. She drew out their chat for 5 minutes, until the doctor gave her permission to go back in for a short while longer. Marie asked about the tunnels, but this time she saw no comprehension at all. Elizabeth said that she had never heard Mr. Broom speak of tunnels or underground rooms at Windrush. She had been there several times with him, but never alone. Marie placed the evidence bag back on Elizabeth's lap and raised her eyebrows.
Any more thoughts on this?
Philip,
she said suddenly.
They were for the cages for some of the animals at his veterinary surgery. The unlucky ones.
Marie's head spun. Philip. Philip Groves.
How do you know Philip the vet?
I work for him.
For the first time, she really smiled.
Only as a volunteer, of course. I love animals. I've been helping out there in my spare time for years.
And you wrote these for Philip Groves?
Marie pointed to the cards.
I'm not sure,
she murmured.
I thought his labels had names like Fluffy and Rocky on them, and little pictures of bones and paw prints. Oh dear, maybe I'm getting confused.
Her hands began to twist again. I think that's enough now. Dr. Mason stood up. Marie felt like screaming with frustration. The two detectives thanked Elizabeth, and they left. As they waited for their escort, Rosie said softly,
Guess who I remind her of?
Marie raised an eyebrow.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Very droll, Sarge. No, I remind her of someone called Fleur.
The oldest victim, Marie breathed.
So what's the connection between the first girl to die and Elizabeth Sewell? I'm not sure, but she was pretty annoyed with herself for having told me. I asked her who Fleur was, and she clammed up, went on to talk about Micah.
What did she say about him?
She's desperate we find him, and she said something rather odd.
Rosie frowned.
She said that you and I should leave him to the men to sort out.
Meaning what, I wonder?
Well, I reckon she's meaning he's a danger to women.
That's not exactly news. I should think Micah is a danger to anyone. Rosie lowered her voice as the escort arrived.
I don't think that's what she meant. I'm certain she was warning me.
Outside in the fresh air, Marie unlocked the car and flung her handbag onto the back seat.
Right. Back to the station, Rosie. And your first job is to check Philip Groves' vet practice. See if the unlucky ones get nice little name cards with paw prints on them, courtesy of kindly voluntary worker Elizabeth Sewell.
Will do, Sarge.
And what then?
I'm even more anxious to discover all we can about Fleur. Her connection to Elizabeth puzzles me,
and it could be a major lead if we can identify her. Pitch in with Max on that one.
As they crawled slowly through the town centre traffic, Marie asked Rosie what she